Hello, horror fans. Welcome back to Selling the Scream, a show about horror movies brought to you by one horror nerd and one horror noob. I'm Jed Donaldson, the aforementioned noob, and that leaves our co-host, the nerd in this equation. That's Josh, the Burninator Yoakum. How you going, Josh?
I'm doing well. Burning down all the village. Was that the thing?
And the people.
And the people, yeah.
Thatched-roof cottages.
I'm doing well. How are you, man?
I'm never better. Here recording this podcast.
Yeah.
With you. How much better could it get?
Yeah, the episode's so nice. We had to like let it build up like a super combo meter.
I prefer to think of it like, you know, we got a kink in our hose and now we're gonna spray really hard all over the ear holes.
Yeah. They're just standing at the content hose, holding it directly to their face, about to get blasted.
Like this where sound come? No sound.
Yeah. A little bit of a delay on this one. A birthday celebration. How was that show y'all went to?
It was good. It's not the first time I've seen it. I mean, that's a brag, I guess. But
yeah.
We took my oldest son to go see Hamilton. It's in town, and he has expressed interest in it and been listening to some of the songs and stuff. So it was a pretty fun thing to do, to take him there and have him see how the big leagues does it. he's going to be doing like some stage production work in one of his. He didn't want to be in drama.
Yeah.
At least not the acting side of it. So he's got a class where they do all the backstage work, and I thought it'd be cool for him to see a real production.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's that's just as valuable to having the play go on. So as the acting and the directing and the somebody's got to hold that boom mic, man. Somebody's got to
hell yeah
operate them lights.
Use those big rope pulleys to haul sandbags around the theater, I suppose.
Drop them on any errant robbers or Looney Tunes villains.
I was just thinking it was absurd, but if there's actually like a reason for it, a sandbag based security system.
I'm doing well over here. I just I was talking with you a little bit about this before the show started, but gauge the summer by when I get my first sunburn on top of my bald head and my last idiot sunburn, because it's like cooled enough that I mistakenly think summer's over and go out and like completely fry myself. Got working with that. It's it's a good time.
I wish I could put myself in that position and feel empathy for you.
But with your locks and locks of
yes.
New job going fairly well. It's a open warehousey area where everybody can kind of listen to what they want to listen to. If you got like a little radio,
sure.
Finding out that's like several of my coworkers, though, it's kind of a more blue collar job, like to listen to talk radio. And even before I knew it was going to be bad news, when even before I heard the content of what they're saying, just all the voices just sounded like this. Just have you seen these people? Oh, I don't know what people he's talking about, but I bet I'm not going to like what he says.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I kind of knew it was going in a bad direction, because you never hear the word talk radio sound by something positive.
I'm just kind of wondering though if there's ever been like good people who just unfortunately like have that voice, that they're all just like, I reached out to the IRS the other day because I'm donating all that money to charity.
I mean, I could hear that voice saying that sort of thing if it was part of a madcap scheme to steal the love of our hero's life away.
Defraud the state of Mississippi out of their money. Yeah, you're just like, you know, like maybe Jesus had that voice. Maybe he's like, this guy, Pontius Pilate. Like, we should forgive him.
You know what, though? Honestly, with the demographic that that voice tends to lean towards, doesn't it kind of make sense?
But now we don't talk about talk radio voice here, do we?
No, we don't. What we do talk about is horror films, more specifically ones that Josh here has chosen in an attempt to turn me into a fan of the genre. I think I say this almost every time, is you're doing all right.
Respectable batting average.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this time we are heading into dangerous waters, though, because while you have expressed a lot of like of the movies that I've carted out in front of you, the slasher has been choppy. It's been not as many of those score as high marks.
Yeah, and I don't know if I can attribute that just to the, like, if it's just a problem with the actual concept of the movie, like what's going on in them, or if it is that something like that is kind of, like, I guess, well-worn territory in horror. And so for something to grab me and make me enjoy it, it would have to be a little bit more
special, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there has to be like a take on it or something. I think I've kind of talked about this before in like prior episodes, like the Happy Birthday to Me episode, but like I've got a real soft spot for the slashers like this one, The Burning, where it's like that period of time where that formula wasn't really established yet, and it was just sort of like, ooh, like how'd they do Halloween? Like what's our take? What's our version of that? Before like what that version was just got like set in stone. But yeah, this one, The Burning, it's in that kind of first wave. It's a summer camp movie, and it came in the wake of Friday the 13th, but it was in development before that. So
yeah,
I think seeing Halloween and wanting to do your own Halloween, like maybe the mind naturally goes to like, oh, like campfire stories. Like it's like what we did in camp. So it's not like a huge surprise that like a couple of those first ones.
Yeah. Like two summer camp based slasher movies.
Yeah. Get put into development right at the birth of the genre. Yeah, but this one's a little different though, cause I would also call this one, a problematic favorite of mine. it's the first Miramax movie. So it's a lot of very hands-on development in this one from one Mr. Harvey Weinstein.
Are we gonna pun intended that?
Yeah, there's very few things he didn't want to put his hands on, and like, I kind of want to give that warning a little bit here up front. Like, if you're some weirdo that like is really enthusiastic about our show, and then you don't watch the movie until like after we've talked about it, like, if you need to press pause or like maybe consider a career in the high seas to obtain this one, I don't blame you.
that was just vague enough to be helpful.
But it's also kind of like a movie that with Harvey Weinstein, I say his fingerprints all over it. This is sort of like his version of Woody Allen's Manhattan, where it's like it's a very, from an early age, telling on himself the kind of guy he is by like basically how all of the male characters act in this movie, like sort of the whole feel of it. It's a very like.
Yeah, I mean, one of the characters in the movie, which, I mean, have we even announced what it is yet?
I thought we said The Burning up top, but if you haven't, we'll just put that back in there in the edit, right? That's what we're gonna do.
Yeah, we're talking about The Burning, which of course you all knew because we said it already.
Yeah, well, here's the dirty little secret. I assume that most people who listen to the podcast don't just fire it off blind. Like, I don't think there's too many podcasts I listen to where I'm like, I'm not going to look at the title of this one.
Like, just like throwing darts at their like phone screen.
But if this show just started auto playing from you touching it, The Burning, we're talking about The Burning. it's this another weirdo 1981 slasher, like Happy Birthday to Me.
Right. I wanted to say it's weird that this, like, a movie that looks like this isn't like a standout. Like, to me, this kind of seems like all of the movies, all the horror movies that were made, like, in this time frame, because I don't know, they all kind of did this sex and teenagers and violence.
Yeah, they're all chasing Halloween money. They're all like trying to figure out like how they were able to do that, and that also looked like something, like, because it was made on a budget, you could do on a budget and kind of get your foot in the door and be, you know, have a hit under your belt with which to build your career. So the Weinstein brothers were rock and roll concert promoters in the Buffalo area. They got this idea to make this one because, like I kind of mentioned before, like, campfire stories were an easy go-to. And this particular campfire story of Cropsey, have you heard that name before? Do you know Cropsey?
No, not. It sounds familiar when you say it, but I can't tell if that's, you know, I sort of maybe possibly had heard it at some point in the past, or if it's just I've watched this movie in the past 2 weeks. So.
Cropsey, oh yeah, that sounds familiar.
Bouncing around in there. Yeah, of course I heard of it.
So there's a lot of different versions of Cropsey, but this is like a New York camp story, also specifically based in Staten Island.
You're saying that this is like there's an actual mythology around Cropsey outside of the film.
Yeah, that it's, I wouldn't go so far as to say a mythology, but yeah, I guess maybe that works too. It's more of like a telephone version of it, just whatever camp you were at, they had their own spin
made up
on
out
it.
Of whole cloth, like Jason Voorhees.
Yeah, they're using the actual like name that was used. Like, usually it's a hook-handed guy.
Sure.
So they dropped that bit. This guy does not have a hook hand. But it was usually some vengeance seeking former employee of the campground who, you know, again, like this movie, just like Friday the 13th Part 2, has the campfire scene where they pull the scare that you would pull in these sorts of camps in the, you know, 50s and 60s.
Yeah, that's your standard campfire scene rule. It has to happen. whether it's a scary story being told or not.
They have the whole jump out bit. But they put it. Actually, there was another movie based on Cropsey going into production even at the exact same time. There's a movie called Madman that was in production after this one. So they, when they found out about it, they did change the name of their character in it. But it is very much a Cropsey legend story. The other kind of fascinating thing is that there was actually like a guy who was killing kids in Staten Island around that same time. So it was almost like sort of a Candyman-ish situation where like the fears of this real guy who was like abducting and killing children in Staten Island, like, turned into the stories about Cropsey.
Right. Like an actual thing that happened influenced what was going on and kind of became their boogeyman.
Yeah. So it's very fertile ground for people who grew up with that, like, who want to do a Halloween, to do it. And this movie, they were able to get some money together and convince some folks that it was going to happen. And it has kind of a little bit of a pedigree to it.
There were some names and faces that maybe I didn't have to, you know, look up who they were.
Well, there's some definitely like a few standouts in the cast that were, you know, this is a very early role for them. But even at the time, the director, Tony Malam, that they hired was it's like a professional documentary filmmaker who'd made like a bunch of fairly critically well-regarded concert films and stuff in England. So it was like an opportunity for him to make a movie here. And he's like, you know, it's not just some kid with a camcorder and the middle of nowhere. It's like somebody with a background and some skill to actually put images and sounds together to make a movie.
Right, which is why it's such a shock to see what we got.
We'll get there. The score, I don't know if you saw that, if you know who Rick Wakeman is. Would it help you if I told you that he was the owner of a lonely heart, which is much better than the owner of a broken heart? Okay.
All right. Well, I mean, I still don't know the guy, but sure.
He's the keyboardist and one of the songwriters for the band. Yes. So the proggy feel to the synth score in this movie. That is courtesy of Mr. Wakeman. And also, like, the whole reason we're doing this one, you picked Tom Savini out of all our choices last time.
I did.
We did a creep show. Who else you wanted to do a movie by? And I would argue, for as hard as it is to watch this movie in many ways, because it's a sexy creep, the Weinstein movie, is that there's some really good like kill effects in here. I would argue like there's a center sequence in this movie that is maybe one of my favorite, just grisly, crazy out of nowhere death scenes like in any of these slashers. Or do you recognize, do you know the one I'm speaking of?
I think I do, yeah.
Okay. Did it stand out for you at least as something that maybe I would spend some time on?
Yeah, maybe I got a little whiff of that.
So this cast, though, do you want to talk about some faces maybe you recognize in this one?
I mean, obviously, first for me was Fisher Stevens.
You know, our greatest Indian American actor was. young Fisher Stevens in this movie as Woodstock, the camp masturbation champion.
Proud, loud and proud, I guess.
There's a lot of jerking off in this movie, folks.
I know we're going to talk about this, but that's one of the things I liked, is how authentic it felt.
And how authentic it felt while I was doing it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Fisher Stevens is in this. He's, you know, probably best known as Ben from Short Circuit and Short Circuit 2. Can't believe that was only less than 40 years ago and these movies got made type movies.
It's weird. Like, you forget how recently. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Forget about how recently some of these things that are just like shocking to your sensibilities now came out. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's only a handful of years.
I just rewatched the first Short Circuit because I was like, I don't want to watch two with my kid. But like, I remember one being like, he's less in it. I was just like, oh, they pack him being offensive into so much of his time.
that's the one where Johnny Five had a laser, right? Or was that two?
I haven't watched two in recent history, but he had a laser in the first one. I just rewatched that one. But we will be talking a little bit about things that might be like artifacts of their times as we talk about this movie.
Sure.
As well. But he went on to do a bunch of other roles, but he also like directs and is like a documentary filmmaker and stuff too. So
yeah, he's not like 100% known for being a racist caricature. He's done other stuff, guys.
Nobody talks about the other stuff Al Jolson did, right?
Like, yes, all right. Fine.
Dedicated father.
Well, let's get on to one of the other guys then. It was what's his name? George Costanza's in this movie.
Jerry, I was in a slasher. Yes, he is. Jason Alexander is awesome, and I of course, you know, won a whole bunch of awards playing George Costanza, but like he's if you thought the volume of performance in Seinfeld and other things you've seen him in was something he developed later in his life, not the case. This is he had it right.
I mean, this is proto George.
It is my headcanon that after the traumatic events of this film, Dave, his character, who survives, changed his name and tried to distance himself and
put those memories behind him, which honestly reasonable.
Who wants their Festivus tainted with these the memories of the worst 24 hours of your life? And then we also had I don't know if you noticed her because it's not a big part, and I don't think she comes on the boat trip that makes up a good chunk.
I know who you're talking about. I noticed in the credits, but I didn't realize who it was while I was watching.
Sophie, it's one of the younger girls who stays back at camp, is Miss Hallie Hunter.
I saw that name go through the credits. I was like, fucking where?
It's just like her and her like piano garb in the background, like traipsing through this movie. It's a stacked cast. A lot of these slashers, like especially the ones that were done by like the New York exploitation filmmakers, got to kind of take advantage of like a wealth of young talent in the New York theater scene.
It seems crazy, but I mean, when you think about it. It'd be crazy if, it'd be just as crazy if we didn't ever hear about this stuff, these people, because they didn't make it. We have the benefit of, actually having lived through their success.
But it's good. Getting back to, we picked this because it was a Tom Savini flick. Let's talk a little bit about Tom Savini. It makes for a better topic than Harvey Weinstein. this is not the first Tom Savini movie we've done. He did Creepshow. He did Friday the 13th Part 4 that we watched, and also Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. So I think you might get a sense of what Tom Savini's good at, what he is known for.
Yeah, I think I can sense the vibe there.
it's important because he's not like a I think I mentioned on the last time, the Creepshow episode, he's not a like a creature effects guy. He's not like a Rick Baker who makes like werewolf transformations or doing The Fly. That's not Tom Savini's thing.
An axe jammed halfway through someone's face.
Yeah, or you need a corpse that looks like as real as you want it to. you're gonna get Tom Savini. Also kind of a multi-hyphenate. He's an actor and a director. He actually did the Night of the Living Dead remake from 1990. Surprisingly, like, really good. Like, you have a classic like the original. They do like the remake, especially kind of like, 1990, you start to get a little worried, but like it was really well done. The things that they changed like made sense. It also had like good suspense and stuff. Like, it was well done.
Well, then let's watch it for the show.
It is typically hard to find. It might be out there at some point now, but I know it's like very infrequently on streaming services. But I think what you probably would know him best for, of course, is Bray Wyatt's Mask, right?
I think what I knew him best for was that guy in From Dusk Till Dawn with the dick gun.
Sex Machine.
That's the name, yeah.
Which is a variation on the character he played in Dawn of the Dead. He's the like one of the gang, the bike gang leaders, and that's kind of like part of why I think his name is like out there and why he's like got kind of the reputation that he does, is that he also is like a character and he's an actor, and he like when he goes on like talk shows and stuff, like he does really well because he's a card, like probably a little bit better than like a just somebody who doesn't have that skill set. So he gets out there and kind of gets that name.
He got that charisma.
Yeah. Because I mean, who doesn't love Sex Machine, right? Like that's.
I mean, fuck, you pulled that name right up.
I maybe also have recently done some research on Tom Savini. So. He's also like a, you know, he doesn't really do effects makeup anymore, but he runs a school to like train folks to do it, and because of his name, he gets offers all the time. And then kind of a cool thing that he does is he kicks all those offers to like the students of his school. So he's like, I'm getting all this shit because of my name, but you can't have me, but here's like 10 people I recommend that were students of mine. Like, so.
Do they like have a lottery, like Hunger Games style?
I can only assume. Like some elaborate death ritual they have to do. He was a friend of George Romero, so he did a lot of those early George Romero ones. He was actually set to do, like, he was super young, but they wanted him to do Night of the Living Dead. But he was drafted to Vietnam, and he credits a lot of like what his makeup effects look like, because he was a war photographer.
Sure.
And he would actually like he would take pictures of bodies, and like he said, the only way that he could like do it, because it was so horrifying, was to like think of it as makeup effects. So when he came back, you know, he noticed that a lot of times in movies, like somebody would die and they just kind of pristinely go and fall aside. He's like, no, that's not what death looks like. You know, you go slack jawed, and like sometimes you die with one eye open and one eye shut, or like it looks like you're smiling, or
right.
So he's able to, in like Dawn of the Dead in particular, make zombies that have a lot of, you can put together kind of how they died from what they look like, and they have a lot of personality. The color correcting didn't work out as well in that movie, so the blood's a little like hot pink, but you know, still pretty. I think you don't get to where like modern effects are with like sort of real looking gore without Tom Savini. So
no, I mean, why? That's a pretty good distillation of why I wanted to kind of see more of his stuff, because that's what I hear.
Yeah,
the buzz
yeah.
around the block.
And I think there's some really cool stuff in this. There's also he toured for it, even though it was kind of like a lower budget movie. I think I mentioned in the Friday the 13th Part 2 episode that he did this instead of Friday the 13th Part 2, mm-hmm. because he thought the whole hook of no, Jason's been alive this whole time was the dumbest fucking thing he'd ever heard. And he takes some credit for the sting at the end of the first Friday the 13th for like creating Jason, and he's just like, what are you doing with my dumb dream ending?
My like, boy.
But you wanna go ahead and get into this one? Let's
talk about it.
Yeah, so we get the birth of Cropsey here first. We get the famous early slasher trope that kind of goes away by like 83 or so. You don't see too much of this anymore. The prank gone wrong.
these kids committed a crime.
Oh, it always is. It's always like all these movies. It's just like, wouldn't it be hilarious if we dug up her mom and threw her body at her?
No, that would be. I mean, what can I say? People back then knew how to go hard and take a joke.
Yeah. And you'd laugh about it, because if you didn't, we'd beat you to a pulp. but it's campers who are mad at Cropsey. They hate this jerk.
They give us no explanation beyond that. Just they don't like this old man. he's apparently mean, but we're given no reason to believe these children.
And this actor they got to play like non-burned Cropsey looks like Jackie Earle Haley if he was playing Chief Wiggum. It's like just to give you kind of an idea of what Cropsey, he's like a drunk derelict asleep in a dirty shed.
Full of gasoline.
Full of gasoline pornography.
Alcohol just like bottles spilled all over the place.
Loose matches, fireworks. Just that's where I keep my sodium.
Tanks of pure oxygen.
So the prank is these kids got a hold of a head, or like created a reasonable facsimile of one, but does not look.
I hope like they just kind of arts and crafted it together at one of their camp sessions, because if they dug up someone's actual head,
it's like full of worms and dirt and stuff. And they have a candle lit inside of it, and Cropsy wakes up and topples this nightmare that he's woken up to onto his sheet, sets himself on fire, and we got a live burn, baby.
Hell yeah.
This one, maybe like compared to some of the other ones we've done, and I want to, as always, mad props for anybody fucking crazy enough to do a live burn. Looks like they added a lot of petroleum jelly onto this one. This burn suit, he catches on fire, and all of a sudden it's like the Michelin Man on fire. Like, ah! Just,
most of the time, it looks like the flame adds a few pounds, but sometimes it looks like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
So that's not the only, you know, bit of our cold open here. Before pre-credits, we also get the Cropsy in the hospital as a orderly, like, is like, oh, you're going to medical school and you're gonna start being an intern here. Well, I'm taking you to see the most fucked up shit.
He's not only that, he's like guilt tripping or shaming this guy, this doctor. Saying like he'll never be a real doctor if he doesn't see this shit.
It does kind of have the, again, like so much of this movie feels like a sleazy porno. This sort of feels like a cucking movie.
Yeah.
This orderly cucking this intern for like, you aren't doctoring well enough. Your patients don't want you, little man. Yes, she.
I don't know what you're talking about, Josh.
He describes him as a fucking Big Mac. Which, like, is that like, if you think of a burned food as like Big Mac, honestly, the first one you go to, like, you know, it's real seared, burnt to a crisp, like a Big Mac.
That's the wrong burger franchises thing.
We get this jump scare here where, you know, they go in to look at him. He hasn't moved and he's real messed up, and they get just kind of the arm come out and the grab and the scream. And now we get our title drop. This I don't think we've really done like a grimy New York movie yet, have we?
Jason was in Manhattan.
But that was like late 80s Manhattan, and like,
oh, he came in like a tourist, and he hit all the big sites.
Yeah. Mostly hit the Canadian part of town. Oh, you want to go over to Little Toronto? Well, you're in Little Vancouver right now, friend.
Get some of those Canadian foods.
but this open where, first of all, like, I love the voiceover of just like Cropsy's getting dismissed from the hospital. It's just like, well, that was terrible. Off you go, though. Move on with your life.
basically say, well, we know this has been tough. Don't hold a grudge against those kids, and I don't know, just kind of deal with it.
You know, a scathing indictment of our medical system. As soon as Cropsy's his insurance.
I know this was traumatic, but, you know, you suck it up. I'm sure you'll get over it eventually.
If you want some more treatment, look, get some more insurance. So, of course, the first thing he does when he gets out is scour the seedy streets of New York City with his Vaseline vision. So,
you know, you work with what you got on a budget.
With his Rick Wakeman score behind him, and goes to go, you know, just have a pleasant chat with a social worker.
I'm, you know what? I was all set to kind of pick on this a little bit, but honestly, I think I would want to know if it still worked.
Or if you would need to use scissors as a substitute.
Right, exactly. You got to know.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this movie certainly has an attitude towards women. Not a great one, but
yeah, it does lead to this. It sucks. And yeah. It sucks they even have to kind of, you know, put a tag on this and say, you know, movies of that time were just kind of like this. Like, that's not cool. It should never have been like that. But I think it's unfortunate that it doesn't stand out a bunch of, among a lot of
other yeah. things
from the time period.
I mean, I think something else that's like can maybe get lost in this, like talk about, like, I think seeing something like this also just makes people recognize how normal it was.
Yeah.
That it wasn't like a particularly heinous thing at the time. That, like, I in some ways, I think kind of these lower budget, you know, by the seat of your pants type movies, that just kind of like do a lot of, don't have a lot of highfalutin pretensions and just want to show things as they are, like, do show us more as like of what the times were like, as opposed to like a, you know, tightly scripted drama. And sometimes it's an elaborately costumed piece. Like, no, this is actually what people looked like in the early 80s. Short shorts and all.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned authenticity already.
Yeah.
We're still hitting it.
Yeah, no, it definitely stands out now. And that's like kind of why I had mentioned up top, like, problematic favorite. Cause it's like, there's a lot to like here. There's a lot of cool gore effects. And, like, again, people kind of like scrambling to figure out how to make this thing work. Yeah. Cause she gets a scissors to the gut, but it's like, it's a good dummy. And, like, it's a pretty gnarly, like,
yeah,
effect, I mean, into it.
Like, you can think about it and go, okay, I can see how it's done, but it still looks good enough that you know, knowing the trick doesn't really make it less.
Yeah, yeah. But like now we've established our killer. He kind of gets the fuck out of this movie for quite a while. He gets like another establishing shot just to kind of show, like, he gets like two or three of them to just sort of show he's about. But yeah, he's
come back to camp.
Yeah, but most of the next, like, this is a different camp. This is it's like Blackfoot and
right. I think at some point in the movie they discuss that this
used to be
story come from another camp, and that camp is gone now, or something yeah. to that effect.
But you know, we don't find out till the end that maybe there is a personal connection here. It's not just a random camp he's picked out. But yeah, most of the rest of this is just kind of introducing us to camping, to this camp full of perverts.
Right, real people, real folks. Yeah. Josh, come on.
Folks from the 80s, like Mr. George Costanza. Oh, you smoothie, you.
I had a point that I was going to make, and now I can't remember what it was.
You've been George Costanza? You've been...
Bamboozled.
Forgot my point, Jerry.
Oh well, couldn't have been that good.
But we're introduced to these these young people playing softball, and I think another thing that's like, I think works really well in this movie's favor, and one of the things I really liked about Friday the 13th Part 2 is it's like there's a lot of people here. It's like it's a whole camp.
Right, and you don't have to look at the, you know, the credits at the end to know the names of these campers, because they're actual, like, most of them have a character.
Yeah, and we get to, like, know who they are for a while before anything bad starts happening to any of them. Well, I mean, bad things are happening to all of the women all the time because they're with these men, but before, like, the horror movie part.
Just Part of the time period, baby.
Things were just better back then.
I don't want to say better. I'll say different.
I'll say different, but I'll wink while I'm doing it.
You know me well.
So the camper who does have like the initial near encounter is Tiger. Do you have anything you want to say about Tiger? Maybe start talking about some of these characters since we get to know him.
I don't know how old Tiger is.
No one does. No one knows how old Tiger is. She's 8 sometimes. She's 17 other times.
I've 23, 24.
She has the haircut that my younger brother referred to in his youth as his big yellow mushroom hair.
I was going to say, he looked like your brother.
Yeah, Tiger doesn't have like a huge role in this movie, but she makes an impact. She leads with that unfortunate just explosion, the bowl explosion. Like imagine if Mo Howard was blonde and his head shrunk. And that's kind of the tiger haircut.
In a nutshell. Painting a picture with your words.
But yeah, I don't know how old she is. She's like shown to be like needing to be coddled during the story. Right. Time, but also she, smoking.
You know for a fact, like two things. All right. She's not a counselor.
Yeah.
You don't know how fucking old she is.
maybe she's a Tigger. Just came up bounding out of the woods one day. Yeah, no, I think I'm even looking at my notes here. You mentioned like the age I have. Is she 8 or 16? No one knows.
Yeah, I mean she's having grown up conversations and doing grown up activities, but she's clearly there in a like a capacity that needs to be cared for.
Do you think she's like just really good at camping? That she's like a Doogie Howser of camping? Like this is normally for teenagers. They let her. We're also just introduced to like Dave and Eddie. So we got Jason Alexander is Dave, who's kind of the mover and the shaker at this camp. He's the guy who procures the things you need and takes up the most volume in any room.
Yeah.
I think he just kind of came in and was like, should I read it like this? Like, you need more lines. I won't be killed though. Fine. Yeah, he's conferring with Eddie, who's many of our these are very New York characters.
It is it's a very New York sounding movie.
Yeah, he's maybe the most forget about it of like all the guys at the camp. Narrowly like out New Yorking, I think Glazer, but I'll put that in your. which who's from deeper in the boroughs, do you think?
Blazer's like unstuck in time.
He's like a 1950s Stephen King greaser bad guy from like an early novel.
Like he's just enough of a indefinite blob of like cliched badness that you can kind of slide him into any time era.
He's also like weirdly enough sort of more like the Chad of the group. Like he's really bad at like flirting with the girls, but he also like doesn't seem as like malicious as some of the other guys. He's like, I'm sticking up for my girl.
Yeah, you get a sense that when he says my girl, he means it.
Like he really does like Sally. He's really like, you know.
Yeah, it's just, he's got this stupid macho facade thing he's got to keep up.
Because I'm so bad at sex.
I mean, they do a lot to kind of humanize him towards the end part of the movie. And that's, I don't know. I don't need to know that.
Again, movie written by Harvey Weinstein, so I think it's like, ooh, I don't like this guy. This guy would have picked on me when I was a kid. Like, make it so he can't get his dick hard. Yeah, our other younger camper who's kind of important is Alfred, Brian Backer, who's in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He's maybe the Weinstein stand-in. He's the, you know, when Woody Allen casts like Owen Wilson to be right. Basically Woody Allen.
He is, yeah, he does look, he's like, it's like Woody Allen playing Harvey Weinstein. But he's like almost positioned as like our sympathetic, like underdog lead character.
We should feel so bad for him because he like got caught like
right in our first
on a girl.
Our first acknowledgement of him as a character in this movie is that he gets caught presumably fondling himself outside of the girl's shower.
And gets caught and like is like, oh, but I don't really have friends here and nobody likes me.
Right, we basically at the equivalent of that Simpsons courtroom scene with the verdict of boys will be boys.
I mean, that's kind of a lot of the vibe of this movie. And I think it's like, again, I sort of, it's the problematic fave of it where it's like you, it feels so authentic. Like you were like, I think you, like you've said a few times, it's just like, people talk about like Blazing Saddles being a movie you can't make today. Right. The Burning is a movie you cannot make today.
Right. It's,
you should not make today.
Right. It's a strange distinction that like you kind of just kind of know when you see it. Is it something that, like this that feels almost grimy? And I don't mean like it dirty. I mean like you can see like fingerprints and like proof that this is something that lived and had a heartbeat.
Yeah.
As opposed to people trying to write this way and making it sound like all clinical and smooth. There's just something lived in about the characters and the setting here.
And I give a lot of credit for that to Tony Malam, who did like a lot of documentaries. So I think he like really encouraged a more natural like camaraderie among people. Yeah. And wanted them to kind of to really have it feel lived in and not as cut and dry as you were saying.
I know maybe it's a little late to kind of to give this little criticism, but maybe, you know, advice or whatever, that maybe people, you know, in the area that this film was made should take notes.
So we kind of have like our hero couple here too, Michelle and Todd. They're like the head counselor couple. I don't know maybe if we've had like as much as we're talking about kind of how fleshed out like the other characters are, like boy, these feel like kind of nothing people to me. I don't know if they.
Yeah, they're really pretty empty.
They're nebulously good. I guess the actor who played Todd is like, you know, was off the stage and like Weinstein like thought with his dark hair he didn't look like he had blonde hair, he didn't look like a macho enough guy, so he just dyed his hair like brown for the movie. And that's like, I think a brown dye job is maybe where I would classify that performance. Like,
harsh but fair.
His girlfriend Michelle is like, she had a little bit more of a career after this, and I think she's okay. I think she's more like, she doesn't have as much to do, but she's suitably like panicked well enough. She is first in maybe one of my favorite cinematic traditions, reporter girlfriends in Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. She's the reporter girlfriend from Bloodsport.
I mean, it's a specific list.
It's longer than you'd think. It's like, JCVD, we're writing this movie for you. Like, who should your romantic interest be? It should be a reporter trying to get to the heart of why I'm so cool.
That's her story. She's not on assignment.
People say you're a badass. Can you prove it by doing the splits? Oh my god.
He can.
Again, like, Alfred, this is a prank that he's trying to write off his like his masturbation. Right. He's trying to prank her.
That's like the most believable excuse.
Which, like, you know, I guess pulled that prank on like a stack of Hustler magazines June through December 1986 that I had access I found in the woods.
Yeah, he pulled the prank all right.
But the kind of this whole setup is that there's a few little scares here. We establish these characters a bit more. We know that like Eddie wants to have sex with the pair of panties that he sees again, male gaze in this movie. We know that Glazer and Sally want to hook up. There's the we've got our lovable scamp underdog campers and their counselor who's like very interested in how much they jerk off for some reason.
I don't know if you knew this, Josh, but you know, back then when you owned a summer camp, you had to sign. There were rules, like, and you had to stay below a certain number, or you wouldn't get financing for next year. Very important.
It's like they all have those prisoner notches by the side of their bed that
you can get a merit badge for it.
But he's like, you know, procuring adults magazines for them as well. But I, as much as I kind of talk about that, that's he is a very likable scamp character in this, even if he's also participating in the toxic masculinity on display here. He's maybe the only one, maybe the only like genuinely likable guy in this movie.
You know, aside from people that aren't given enough for me to even form an opinion of, I don't think I could argue that.
Did you think that this movie would qualify for a Mr. Skin entry for Jason Alexander and Fisher Stevens fans? Are you glad you got to see some bare buns, some bottoms as they mooned Glazer for the revenge prank, shooting someone with a gun?
The stuff that they're able to get away with.
It's a pellet gun, but still, like, you know.
I you know what? Honestly, they portray Glazer as, like, this bully and a shithead, this just big, dumb brick of a person, but they kind of asked for it.
I mean, a little bit. It's hard to, like, take the bully's side, but sometimes the bullies are right. I think we're learning in our current climate, like, all movies must be my kinds of movies. Like, no, you should have been shoved into a locker. Like, the Glazers of this world should have kept you in place. But it's the centerpiece of this movie, like, where all the bad stuff starts, is this river trip, where, like, many of the characters go on. It's, like, less than the population of the camp.
But, right, it's like only the people who were there for like their last year or whatever. Like, it's the last time they would be considered eligible to come to camp because of age limits, I guess.
Yeah, and also Tiger question mark.
she Tiger is there. She's always been there.
Always has been. We get some banjo good time music and some more like actual gen like capering. Like, this is the jokes where they're just like piling water into somebody's boat. That's, you know, right. One of their few jokes in this movie that's not a sex crime.
I've been on canoe trips. This is how they go.
But it's I think it really establishes, again, like, this movie takes a while. Like, we're kind of, I wouldn't say blazing through, because I think we're going longer on this one than I anticipated. Yeah, but, you know, it does let you live with these folks before the bad times start.
Yeah, I mean, I can see an argument for both, but I definitely prefer when we get to spend a little more time making these things into more of a 3D image than just the paper thin whatevers.
And we get our first like telling of the Cropsey story, which like when you find out that, you know, we'll get into the end spoiler just right up here, because I think the end spoiler deserves to be considered because of this moment, that Todd is telling the Cropsey story, and he's telling it just as a campfire story with like a big jump scare at the end. But like the twist of the movie is that he's one of the people responsible for like burning Cropsey alive.
Yeah, he left camp immediately and started doing fitness and weight training. Probably visited several doctors to get plastic surgery done. It's only 5 years later.
Oh, I mean, it's only 5 years between this movie and Short Circuit.
What I'm saying is the guy from the flashback is a completely different person than this camper.
Yeah. I love was edited around in the beginning so we wouldn't get the spoiler, like, are you in Snoop? Are you in Todd? Yes. But like, again, this like he's telling this story is just like, you know, well, here's the camp, what I've heard around the, and then his friend jumps out and scares. It's like, again, that feels so much different. If it's like you were an active participant,
you did this.
But
yeah, if this presumably traumatic and like defining point of your early life, because they were a camper at the time, they weren't even counselors. Like, they're young. this momentous event didn't have some sort of impact. Or so little impact that you can, you know, tell other people about it as if you weren't there.
Yeah. Now it's just a good yarn. It seemed real scary at the time, but in hindsight, kind of hilarious.
Entertaining, you know.
Which I think it's not told as well as the campfire story from Friday the 13th, but I do like the kind of stinger of it, don't look, they'll see you. Don't breathe, he'll hear you. Don't move, you're dead!
That's it's like custom made to go on a poster for the movie.
Yeah, and I think it might have been on one or two of them. Along with, you know, the watching, waiting, anticipating. So the girl that Eddie is trying to get with is Karen, who's this movie does not, I will admit a fault up front, does not treats everybody kind of like shitheads. It doesn't bother developing most of the women at all. Karen's just right. Like hot and cold on Eddie, which like
right.
Also Sally is hot and cold on Glazer, and that's basically their like character traits. Like, I want to have sex, but no, stop it. But I want to, but no, stop it.
Oh, now you're blaming them.
That's just how they're written. That's like, yeah. The
no, you're right.
Yeah, that's like, again, I think from the point of view of the Harvey Weinsteins of the world.
Just yeah, like if that's like the only experience you've ever had with a woman, or the only experience you've perceived yourself to ever have.
Yeah.
It's kind of right, like, that, I guess.
But they have this, like, they do some skinny dipping over in the day for night. And they, you know, when Eddie tries to press on her, she, Karen flees out into the woods, but her clothes have been strung along as she leaves Eddie out to, like, cool off. And then she gets to be our first Cropsey victim here on this trip. After that,
should have been Eddie.
well, Eddie gets his.
Oh no, yeah, he does.
But the she gets her throat slashed out here, and like again, like this kind of pre-MPAA cracking down on this stuff. So like in a slasher movie in like the late 80s that had a theatrical release, like you wouldn't see a throat slash like this, like where it like actually dragged across and like spurted mm-hmm. blood out.
Yeah. Using his signature weapon, the oversized garden shears. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Clock Tower, baby.
Yeah, I had thought.
Which, you know, can't beat like Crippled Masters, like most obscure reference we've made on this show, but might be like top four or five.
There is a small audience for that, which is, you know, good for us since we have a small audience.
the PlayStation 1 game Clock Tower, ladies and gentlemen, the PlayStation 1 Clock Tower. But this triggers that I think, again, in like most of their slasher movies, there wouldn't be kind of this break between like victims. Like she dies and then they wake up and all their canoes are gone. And like they know Eddie was the last person seen with her.
Right.
He's like indignant and mad about it. But they kind of like,
all they know is that she's missing. Like they don't know, you know, they don't know she's dead. They think she stole the canoes.
Yeah. Or like that she was taking one back to and maybe accidentally like let them all loose when she was taking one. But yeah, it's this thing where they're like now stuck out in the wilderness and having to kind of cobble together a plan. And it's like, you know, idiot teenagers and young adults trying to scrap something together and get back home, having to put those camping skills to their ultimate test.
The camping that we were going to do anyway, and then have to find sticks too to make a raft.
there's like the joke that doesn't age that well, where they're like, oh, well, as you figured out by now, our canoes are missing. And like somebody shouts out like, I sold them to some Indian guy. And just like Fisher Stevens' eyes start darting back and forth.
Who said that?
There's also like, again, like I love that this is maybe where we see some of these like actual formulas start to get established in these, where, you know, somebody's missing and it was like kind of this weird kind of rapey sex crimey situation. And then they like cut away to like our other problematic couple, like, no, we're looking for people, but why don't you get with me, Sally? Glazer and Sally.
Awkward, authentic young love.
With just, you know, that awkward, authentic, are one of the heroes of our movies still like peeping on them?
Oh, yeah. So, he's still doing the exact same shit that he got busted for. He never learns.
Not at all. But they start to put together, like you were saying, they're collecting sticks and they put together a raft to go send a small group of folks back.
I do like this big break here.
Yeah.
Like you said, they start the killing and then there's like a long time between the first and the next one. Because it like you watch a little more and you kind of figure out, oh, he actually did have time to do some of the stuff that it seems like he did.
Yeah, I mean, it still doesn't make maybe the most sense, but it leads to like probably the most striking scene and visual images in this movie, where they're paddling upstream and they see at least one of the canoes.
Yeah.
And it's this group. It's Fish, who's like another one of the younger kids, like the same age as like Alfred and Woodstock, which is Fisher Stevens, Eddie, who is our sexual assault guy, whose girlfriend, they've like made him go because he had to go back and, you know, explain himself or you know, be accountable for whatever. And like two other characters who don't get as established as much, and they approach this canoe and Cropsy jumps up out of it with the scissors.
I thought for sure like this was gonna be another place where they would ratchet the tension a little bit and we'd actually like find the body.
Like a bloody garment or something.
I would have sworn that they would have found evidence of his first kill, and this is kind of how that gets tipped off.
And I think it's
just him.
Yeah, and it's like it's so disarming because this movie's been moving so slow so far that this scene where like in the span of you know, like 30 seconds, if that, all of these characters are killed off just by Cropsy like chopping and slashing at them with these garden shears. Yeah. And it is some
fingers cut off and
gnarly effects in this one. Like the blade dragged across the head.
Yeah.
And just like, I think what just makes it hit is, again, like, you spend so much time with these folks, and it's also that the early slasher thing of, like, you don't just have, like, four defined characters in this group. You have, like, many characters that have, like, you've built out, and this raft has, like, a mix of developed characters and undeveloped characters on it.
Yeah, like, you can tell the characters that they, you know, wrote as, like kind of tropey things. But everybody has enough development where you go, is he too important to be killed off? Does he have plot armor?
Yeah. And these folks did not. I think especially, like, we kind of mentioned how young some of the folks are. Like, some of these are, like, not counselors. Like, you for, like, a young adults partying, like you find, yeah, in the,
like, Friday, like I said, movies. I would have guessed that most of the, like, the campers would be 15, 16.
Yeah, and I think that's the age most of these actors were. So it's like, it's not older folks playing kids, it's kids that look like kids because they are. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really, and I think just that image of him rising up with the sun behind him, with the shears up, is like, it's such a striking image. Like,
it's a good image, but I gotta question the planning here of killing one person and then hiding in a canoe in case.
You know, after the fire, his brain don't work so good. It's really just luck that anything happened.
I mean, it wasn't even like a canoe that was, like, upright. It was half submerged.
He was just hoping for Jason to come out of the lake and pull him down into it. But yeah, this, I think that scene just is worth price of admission in this one. It's like something that you don't see in the later ones, and it's later slashers, and this is just kind of what you come to this one for. But we go back to our other couple, our Glazer and Sally. Mm-hmm. Have this, you know, they have sex, and is that all I get?
Please, sir, poor gruel.
And, like, even, I guess this, like, feels just, like, awkward. It doesn't feel as, like, rapey as the other, like, sex scenes, but still, like, you got fucking Alfred in the woods peeping on. That's gross.
Yes, Alfred in the woods. It's weird to say that, like, Glazer is, like, one of the more, like, you kind of have more sympathy for him than some of these other people, because, like, even though he's portrayed as, like, a bully, but he kind of seems like he's got a heart of gold.
A little bit, yeah. He's like a
sad sack, kind of, maybe.
He's just a Chad. He's just, like, he's a Johnny Bravo.
Yeah.
But they're going to stay, and he's going to try again. So he goes to go get matches so they can have a private little campfire. And Cropsy shows up and gets her right through the chest with those shears. And again, like, it's not a cutaway gag. It's a...
You see a lot of insertion in this movie.
I think Glazer gets kind of the worst of it. He gets the one where he gets picked up by the shears after he's been speared, like, in the through the under the neck and, like, yeah, into the tree. Area. Like, that's the Tom Savini. Well, like, you know, that, between that and the raft scene, I think those are kind of where he makes his money in this one.
Sure.
And then we get to see, as the other, you know, kids rebuild a raft and flee up the river, something I never thought I wanted to see. Just a sobbing George Costanza. Just, Jerry!
You never thought you wanted to see. Does that mean you actually did want to see it once you got it?
I did once I got it. That's right. I tried the McDLT. It wasn't as good as you said it would be. But everyone flees because Alfred is able to get back and, like, get somebody when Todd comes back with him. Todd gets, like, knocked out. Alfred gets chased into the woods. So our final act of the movie is, you know, our peeping Tom creep, like, who's just, like, they make this kid, like, he's fine in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. In this movie, he's just, like, so sweaty.
Yeah, and, like, My notes about Alfred basically boil down to he actually is a weird creep, though.
But Todd feels for him. I was a weird creep.
Yeah. We birthed the man.
We get this like final chase and showdown where they're fleeing through the woods, and I think there's some fun stuff in here. There's like the when he's creeping along the cliff edge and they found like the abandoned mine, and Cropsey's like on top of the cliff, and he's like kind of having to like, you know, hide himself there.
Yeah, some interesting ideas. I did notice that there were an awful lot of reused scenes in this last like 15-20 minutes.
This is kind of when their budget started to run out. And I think, unfortunately, when I say before that, like, Tom Savini didn't do a lot of, like, creature effects, he had, like, 2 days to put together Cropsey's as the, you know, current look, his burned look.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's bad, but it's, like, I think if he was given, like, a bit more time and budget, like, it maybe would have been a little bit more Freddy Krueger and less, like Madball, like, melted Madball.
Yes, it did. It's weird to say that it kind of came off like a toy in the 80s, considering what the subject matter is, but there actually were toys in the 80s that basically did this exact thing.
I think we've probably talked about before just how fucking wild the 80s was, where it was like, there was like Freddy Krueger stuff like marketed towards children.
Yeah,
like,
kids' birthday party. Rambo. First Blood.
RoboCop. That's RoboCop. Toxic Avenger.
Those are kid-friendly franchises. RoboCop had an animated series.
You could call a 900 number with your parents' permission and talk to Freddy Krueger. Child killer.
I think it's a shame they didn't give the animated treatment to Rambo, though.
I'm sure they probably did. I'm sure there's somebody out there. There's some pilot in some, Cokehead's garage somewhere that they put together for an animation studio. But this like this final sequence in the mine, how does this work for you? I mean, I think we kind of talked about the flashback a little bit when it's just like, oh yeah, now that I see this fire wielded by the man I burned to death, I remember that time we burned a man to death.
That is basically how that happens.
But it's like a real mine that they use. I think it's a cool like setting for this. It's like it's, and again, that actually dark cinematography.
No, I agree. It's hurt a little bit by the reuse of scenery, like the blatant, like I couldn't tell if my stream was skipping or something.
That was like Scooby-Doo where they're like running past the same like table in the hallway.
Yes, exactly that.
I mean, that's the, you know, they did that with Alien. They just moved the camera around and made it a different part of the ship.
Well, there's no, it's not the same thing. I'm saying it's the same exact shot. Yeah.
I'm saying duplicated just frames. As good as Alien.
That's a take you can have.
So Todd comes to save Alfred, who's been like, again, I think kind of a neat little visual in this too, where he's like pinned to the wall with the garden shears, like to
it's a cool idea. It's weird to have this creepy little sex pervert as our damsel in distress, though.
I mean, when you're the Weinstein brothers, right? What you know, I guess. who would I want to see be the
me, but younger.
Saved by, you know, just a handsome guy who tells everybody that I'm a good kid. They have this like a final confrontation where it looks like Todd's gonna get taken out, but Alfred's able to get he's gotten free, and the shears come free, and he's able to stab Cropsey in the back. Who was wielding it? Maybe we need to spend some time on this. Is wielding a flamethrower?
Yeah, I thought that was a strange choice for a burn victim to choose as their weapon of choice.
And I think, like, you know, I think a running theme in the Friday the 13th movies is like that. Where did Jason get this? Mm-hmm. I have a lot less questions about like where Jason got like a, you know, an axe or a, you know, a hunting knife than I do where Cropsey got a flamethrower.
Like, they're in a mine, Josh.
Oh, I forgot. Standard operating equipment for mines.
Mining equipment, flamethrowers.
But of course, we get the fake out death too. We get he's not actually dead from the being stabbed with the shears. He comes back for the final scare before he gets set on fire with his own flamethrower and an axe to the face.
Yeah, it's rough.
Bad day for Cropsy.
Cropsy had a hard life.
it is kind of telling when, like, your burned monster man campfire legend, like, draws a bit more sympathy than most of your, like, leads and heroic characters in this movie. Like, yeah, you know, his parents probably drink. Like, it's just what he knew. Poor Cropsy, poor guy. That's pretty much the burning, other than, like, you know, the cavalry gets called in. We get some helicopter cops. We get the Michelle coming back, and there's a bit of camp drama that's not as important, but we did a but somebody else is telling the story, so Cropsy lives on. Cropsy will return in The Burning 2, which Wikipedia tells me does not exist.
I was going to say, I was pretty surprised. How would they find a way to worm his way out of not dying from that?
There would be, like, something great if, like, peak power era, like, bully to the Academy Harvey Weinstein was trying to, like, make The Burning 2 and get it nominated for an Oscar. You sons of bitches, nominate this film! Like, oh man,
spent a lot of time thinking about that.
No, it's a whole problematic thing. It's a whole I think maybe let's move into the sale, because it's, again, the problematic sale of this one.
Sure.
I argue this is a movie with a few great scenes. It's got that early slasher thing where you kind of don't know who's safe and who's not, because they haven't, like, built the rules yet. It's got, like, a vision to it, but it's also a movie that hates women.
A little bit.
But it's also, like, I'm someone that does not think, for example, like, we shouldn't be able to see, like, Disney's Song of the South. And I'm not celebrating it, but I also think it's, like, important that we know that, like, this used to be okay, and that this – there needs to be some content warning up front, and maybe this is a movie that would benefit.
With context, right?
With context, and also, like, a, hey, like, we are aware of this. This is an artifact of the time, and it also features the work of these other people who kind of did some weird, fun things in their career. Like, it's not all just this one guy's vision, but his fingerprints do weigh on it. So it is absolutely a problematic one.
I mean, separating art from artist is super hard to do. It's hard to know what's right, what's wrong.
And there's definitely, like lines for me. I think I was kind of talking about you with this before with you, but, like, I don't want to do any of the Jeepers Creepers movies. I don't want to do, like,
I think that's fair.
I don't want to do, like, Polanski stuff until maybe he's, like, either faces justice or dies. Like, I feel like maybe the line with me is that Harvey Weinstein is in jail and is, like, paying for his crimes and probably will die in jail. I recognize that line is not the same for everybody, and I have different lines for other people too. Like, I'm not a big Tom Cruise person for a multitude of reasons, but, like, sure. I think everybody kind of defines that. So, If this was not a sale for that reason, I get it. I think there is some stuff here, and as, like, a proof of, like, Tom Savini's work, if you're looking for his signature, which is, like, these gory kills and dead actors that are made to look dead, I think this is a good one for it. We've already covered a lot of his stuff. I think that's, like, no accident too. So yeah, curious where you're at with this one, this secret Friday the 13th movie I've foisted upon you.
Yeah. So I find myself in a position of saying that I like this movie, and I have the hard news to tell you that I like this more than any of the Friday the 13th movies we've watched before.
You can finish it. You can finish it. Where's Corey Feldman jumping up and down on the bed?
I know. I know we talked earlier about the unfortunate authenticity that this movie has to it. Yeah. But I think that's also a way you can kind of connect with it, is that it does feel real. So
yeah, it feels like the killer is like coming to a real camp that's been running all year, and not just like a setup, not just like,
right. It's full of people that actually have, personalities that you can latch on to, or, like or dislike based upon some actual evidence of a character on the screen, as opposed to just being told that, oh, that's what position this guy's playing this week in this movie.
Yeah. No, I'm glad to hear that. I think of the three, I always like to throw like the curveball one in there. That's like either one that I think might be a hard sell, or might be when I present the multiple choice ones. And this one was kind of that. So I'm glad you got some enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, I think if more of the Friday the 13th movies actually gave a shit about the people that Jason was killing. I know it's not, it's not that kind of movie, but
yeah, it's it also like my heart breaks for poor Ginny Field. That's so I've got this Crispin Glover Award for acting excellence here, and I don't think this is a hard one to know who's doing the most in this movie, who's the loudest person in any room that they go into.
The only takeaway from this movie.
You old smoothie, you Jason Alexander, you. he's a fucking treat in this movie. Like I know this is probably one that he's not like. If I saw Jason Alexander on the street and I ran up to him and I said, "Oh my god, I loved you in The Burning."
I think that'd be a strange thing to compliment for, but I can also see, appreciate the deep cut there. I don't think that this is something that I necessarily feel he should be ashamed of, or would be ashamed of.
I think it's maybe just like he's more of a Broadway guy, and like he doesn't go back to the horror well very, very much after this one. So, if he has pleasant memories associated with it, that are maybe that's one thing. But it does not strike me as something that he's like highlighting on resumes to this day.
Right. Yeah.
You want to see my best work? So yeah, we've done our things. We should talk a little bit about next time.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Next time, this is something I've been kind of threatening to pull for a while, but we're doing a giallo.
Oh shit.
We have not really done a giallo yet. We've done like giallo influence things, or things that came kind of like from giallo directors.
Right.
There's also an anime. There's also an anime movie. We have not done one of those yet either. So
yeah, those things like peanut butter and chocolate, right?
In this case, I think really they are. We're gonna do Perfect Blue. Satoshi Kon's Perfect Blue, that's not normally available on streaming, is on Shudder at the moment. So really want to talk about this one, because I think it does a lot of the stuff that both those I like a lot about both those things, giallo and animation. Does some things that you wouldn't be able to do in a normal giallo, and does some stuff you don't normally see in an anime. Tells some stories that was a story that's maybe a little different than if people are just familiar with Dragon Ball, or guys powering up and shooting each other.
You have a certain image in mind when you say anime.
yeah. So looking forward to doing that one.
Sounds good.
Here a bit. Is there anything you wanted to shout out, give special?
I don't have any big shout outs this week. I'll work on actually doing something so I can tell people about it.
Okay. I'm gonna steal yours then. I don't know if we're gonna cover it at any time in the near future on this show, but The only early Jamie Lee Curtis movie I hadn't seen, like during her initial horror run, was Road Games. I just watched mm-hmm. that one from like, I think 81 or 82. Really good. Really, I think not quite Halloween, but I'd definitely say like her best like early horror movie outside of Halloween by sure. a pretty long shot.
Pretty cool. One.
More like Hitchcocky than some of the other stuff. So yeah, check that one out. And until then, please reach out to us if you could on our socials at we are on Facebook, the Selling the Scream group on there. Just answer our questions, we'll let you in. Twitter is at Scream Selling, Selling the Scream at Gmail. Reach out to us there. Also, if you could please leave us a review, a kind word does a lot, especially on iTunes or Spotify, kind of drive the most traffic. The does say here in our the update to the iOS agreements, if you're thinking about leaving a bad review, just that only good reviews get entered into the prize drawing. So ooh. That's
feels yeah. bad. Oh, I mean,
can't that's win just if how don't it is. Play. Gets you know the Mega Millions. Yeah. Until then, join us next time for Perfect Blue. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, thank you.